Registered principal, securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member, FINRA, SIPC, investment advisor representative, Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor, financial planning services offered through Lurea Wealth Management, a registered investment advisor. Cambridge and Lurea Wealth Management are not affiliated. At this point, I would like to introduce our featured speaker, Achilles Lurea, owner and CEO of Lurea Wealth. Achilles has over 16 years' experience in the wealth management field, has advised, provided advice to institutions, 401ks, endowment plans, and nonprofits, as well as to select private clients. Prior to starting in the wealth management business, he was a former international competitor and still holds a third-degree black belt in Shotokan Karate and a former international competitor in several world championships. Achilles, you may begin.
Well, hello, everybody, to my friends overseas, to my friends in Spain. Un gustazo, bienvenidos, to my friends over in the Czech Republic. Dobrý den, jak se máte? And to everybody, welcome, welcome, welcome. First off, I'd like to welcome you to the recent market volatility, and we're going to have some highlights from the 2011 halftime report. We have a lot of people on the call today, both clients and their guests, and friends of the firm joining us today. And we are most certainly happy to have you on this beautiful Friday here in downtown New York City. We also have some members of the media present, and, of course, we would love to welcome them as well. We're going to get started with a little bit of an intro. We're going to go a little bit into the downgrade, a little bit into the market commentary, and then we'll go into the halftime report, and we'll have a short Q&A. So let's get started. Since the announcement of the S&P's downgrade of the U.S. sovereign debt from AAA to AA+, well, first off, let's explain, what does that mean to us? Well, the S&P rating agency, in simple language, is merely stating that the debt, instead of being extremely unlikely to default, the U.S. government being extremely unlikely to default, is no longer able to say extremely. Well, so much for the technical analysis. On the plain side, isn't this the same company that isn't going to explain their methodology of coming to this conclusion? They gave us a couple of points. And they also happened to miss the mortgage bond crisis. By the way, they rated mortgage-backed bonds AAA. So much for that. We need to look at what are the possible negative effects. Some of the possible negative effects were that U.S. bonds were really supposed to drop when this announcement occurred. But instead, this week, they've shown their resiliency, and they've rallied. And today, I believe when I last saw the market, we were up over 169. It's been moving upward trend today, and we've been up, we've been down, and so on and so forth. So we're seeing a pretty resilient market from that as well. What is the possible long-term effect of this decision by S&P? If interest rates rise, then car loans become more expensive. Credit card debt becomes more expensive as well, and debt service to our existing debt becomes more expensive. We have seen, as was to be expected, a whole bunch of turbulence, as well as a whole lot of finger-pointing, and shame on you with the politicians. Oh, well, honestly, that's another conference call, and that could take the better part of a week just to start the conversation, and that's not why we're here. Also, after this announcement, we saw the Dow Jones go down 600 points, followed the next day up over 500. And it's funny, I said to my team, it's really looking like an EKG market. Both, if you've ever seen an EKG, you see the points going up and going down, and I would venture to say your heart was going up and down with it. I would also point out that in addition, that the treasuries not only sustained themselves quite well in spite of the downgrade and went up, we also found just recently as today, mortgage rates are at a nine-month low. They're on the third year, they're at 4.32%. They began the week at 4.39, and the Fed on August 9th pledge to keep interest rates low through mid-2013. We really need to remember that the market, as measured by the S&P 500, has been up over 100% over the past 2 years in some sectors, and corrections along the way are to be expected. Is this a double-dip recession? No, not really. It is, in my opinion, in fact, the beginning of a new recession, albeit a light one, however, not in the traditional sense. Because keep in mind, as per the numbers, the recession that we were in actually ended in June 2009. So much for the double dip. Another point we're watching here at Real Wealth is while year over year GDP growth has dropped just 1.6%, historically speaking, only a rate that has been followed by a new recession in 10 of the 12 times since it's occurred since 1950. Another point I would bring out is when did we decide to protect the bondholders only and that they assumed less risk than shareholders? We were so worried about the bondholders that we missed the fact that shareholders have lost over $1.7 trillion, and I'm hearing it's as high as $4 trillion with the recent events. Bondholders tend to assume the same risk going in. So how did we resolve this? It's a good question. Remind the investors, i.e., the bondholders and the shareholders, of the risk in the marketplace, so that way they in turn can watch the corporate directors more closely as far as how they run the company and their policies. This is only my opinion, and as I like to say, I'm an expert in only my opinion. Well, as the old saying goes, we need to go back in some cases before we go forward. Let's examine the highlights of 2011, and let's see what's happened in order to better understand how we got there. Here locally, we would say, as Warner Wolf would say, hey, let's go to the videotape. In our case, we're going to the PowerPoint. So if you are following us on the web, we're going to go to the first slide here where we have the halftime report, global economies and financial markets, true recovery, big to fail, and we have a lot to cover, so let's dive right in, and we're going to change this. Going to the next slide, we have at the beginning of 2011, we had the Greek bailout, global debt, too big to fail, U.S. housing, unemployment, and confidence. We have a review of Greek history, because we need to find out where we were and to understand since in the 2,600 years of Greek civilization is kind of a good start for our conversation. But just look for the last 2 years here. Five bailouts in 14 months. Alexander the Great must be turning over in his grave. The main issue for all of us is the path that the Greeks and other European economies went down to reach this point. Years of artificially manufactured high living created this problem. Failure to acknowledge it or rein it in made it worse. This is not only a Greek, Portuguese, and Spanish problem in Europe. It exists in the USA, and recent years have shown us that we're paying for that. I'm going to switch from the PowerPoint presentation very quickly, if you'll indulge me for a moment. I'm going to go back to the market commentary this week. I don't know how much everyone's read of it this week, just to go over a couple of points. Going back to how did we get into this situation, we can even go back further, right? We can argue that the debt deluge began in 1966. That year, the first baby boomers were turning 20, and the Bank of America started to license its Bank AmeriCard credit card, now known as Visa. And basically, it was a match made in heaven, as boomers loved to spend their money, and plastic was made easy. And in the mid-1980s, the central banks got into the habit to pursue easy monetary policies, in other words, to avoid recession at all costs, according to The Economist. The weapons of choice were low interest rates and a flood of cheap money. Now, when you combine that with the human's desire to spend money with banks who are willing to lend it and top it off with central banks eager to keep the economy greased, you're going to have a recipe for a massive amount of debt, and that's exactly what's happening here. Like politicians, Americans like to spend money. Between 1985 and 2007, America's disposable income grew 5.9% every year, and household indebtedness grew 8.7% per year, according to the Wall Street Journal. During that time, periods of cheap money, rising consumer debt levels helped fuel the 1982 to 2000 bull market and the 2002 to 2007 bull market, tech stock boom of the 1990s, and housing boom of the mid-2000s. Mirroring the U.S., a similar debt binge was happening with some foreign consumers and some governments as well. And I further went on in there to say, you know, how's it come to a head? When would it end? What was the tipping point? And in the commentary, I mentioned that the tipping point was really more the subprime mortgages. In the mid-2000s, you know, with the cheap money, low credit standards, basically what happened, interest rates began to tick up and people started defaulting on their loans. Soon we had a cascading domino effect. And it ultimately, it pummeled the world banking system, greatly increased debt levels with governments, and led to a steep stock market decline and a deep U.S. recession in 2008. Dramatic levels of government stimulus helped fuel the stock market recovery in 2009 to 2011. But now that the stimulus is wearing off, pretty much left with a hangover. We're going to go back to the presentation because I found this poignant here. We have some on this slide, we say, what are the bulls saying? We're still seeing low bond yields, and that makes stocks still more attractive. We have a steep U.S. curve, a prelude to stronger growth. I don't see that really till 2012, 2013. We still have strong corporate earnings. Companies are much more leaner than they've ever been. We have a U.S. economic cleansing. 4 years into it, the banking system is now recapitalized. The housing market is cheap, most affordable in 60 years, if you can get the financing. And that seems to be something that, well, that's a topic for another discussion. Interesting also to see that consumers are living within their means. Past prosperity. U.S. companies that are controlling the virtual economy. You have eBay, PayPal, Apple, Facebook, LinkedIn, Groupon, and the like. And the U.S. role as a world leader. We feed the world, we keep it secure, and invent a large part of the best medical science. Let's go to the bears. What are they saying? What could cause a large drop in the stock market in the middle of 2012? And for an equal time, we have a bearish argument summed up in one very comprehensive source who put it pretty well. And this is, I'm going to quote Douglas McIntyre from 24/7, the Wall Street blog. The recovery is uneven. Some regions of America are almost economically dead. Underwater mortgages, and we'll expand that on a bit, more than a quarter of the U.S. mortgages are underwater. Stocks are expensive. They look cheap in late 2007 until earnings collapse. Inflation. You can't afford higher food, clothing prices when incomes are not moving up in tandem. Companies are hoarding cash. The dividend increases help shareholders, but not really anybody else. Everybody's shedding their workforce. Once again, companies becoming leaner. Companies are not hiring as before. Plus, we're also seeing, for the first time in a while, government layoffs. China's slowing economy. Many American firms need those sales in China. Greece is tanking. We already went into a little bit of that. So the next slide we're going to pay attention here to. We have the S&P index. And this was as of July 11th, and it's going to look a lot different from this point. But at the time, you know, for the index price, we were at 1307, which would be a negative 16.5% index. But I think it's more important to take a look at the state of U.S. housing and real estate, because these are contributing, as I mentioned to you before, a tipping point. Homes are more affordable. they're more affordable than ever before. As we mentioned before, the 30-year is down to 4.32%. But how low can they go? Prices in housing have yet to find a bottom. Data on the sales of new homes is bittersweet. In other words, homes are being sold, but many are situations that involve a short sale or foreclosure. You don't need us to tell you that the most popular sign in a strip mall today is for lease. Let's take a look at unemployment. At this point in the recovery, the U.S. is way behind past recoveries in restoring jobs that were lost. By now, it would have been unreasonable to think that we could have closed the gap completely, but in fact, we're nowhere near that point. This, more than anything else we can discuss in the presentation, is a thorn in the side of progress towards the next economic boom. In the next slide, many of those who are working would like to be working more and would like to find a full-time job. Sad but true. In the next slide, even sadder is the possibility that some jobs are gone forever. Unemployment is no longer a temporary state for many, and the key to turning things around will be finding new growth industries. Gas prices surged for the second time in the past 3 years, and the impacts on the economy and the psychology of a nation can be felt. Can you remember gas prices at $1.06 a gallon? Well, neither did we. Inflation is tame. The government releases two forms of inflation data each month. One includes the entire index, and the other excludes food and energy. With food and energy surging in price lately, the two versions of the index are now quite far apart. Investing is an emotional cycle, and it repeats itself over and over. We've observed that there are short-term and long-term variations of this, and they play out to the markets on a regular basis. The good news is that in all of this, there has been a number of available diversification tools in the approach greater than ever before. The picture is a particularly valuable one for investors to understand. It shows the results of a study that concludes there are many paths to arrive at a similar long-term outcome. The question for every investor to answer uniquely for themselves is what combination or participation in up markets and protection in down markets is the best fit for the risk tolerance. Goes without saying. To combat the ongoing volatility in a time of economic malaise, dividends, which have been largely ignored as a component of the total stock market return, could again become more meaningful to the investors, as evidenced in this chart. The upper chart shows the assumed 10% return in stocks over the long run is quite a myth. Many 10-year periods have produced annual returns well under 10%. And this really adds to the attractiveness of dividend income as part of the total return to stocks. I'm going to switch from here back to just a couple of quick points on the commentary before we wrap up. Going back to the commentary, realistically, it took the developed world decades to get into this situation, and it's going to take a couple of years of deleveraging to get out of it. There really is no magic bullet that's going to quickly turn the economy into a growth machine. As your advisors here at Laurea Wealth, we really strive to develop a plan that over time has the possibility of providing you with stability and return that you're going to need for long-term planning needs. While we can't make any guarantees about performance or control what the market does, we are still searching high and low for a plan and a strategy that we believe is appropriate to you, and that itself lends to our four-step investment management process, creating portfolios based on an asset and sector classes. In other words, Warren Buffett says, find a trend, throw yourself in front of it, and you should do well. The second one is to use a watch list to monitor an eclectic group of best-in-class non-proprietary investment vehicles. Third is to use multiple qualitative and quantitative analysis tools to improve our buy-sell decision-making processes. And the last is to track and monitor legal insider trading activity to enhance both entry and exit decision-making processes. This, along with a sell discipline, one of the sell discipline points is that when the trend's gone, you run for the hill, others being technical and qualitative in nature. And once again, you decide the percentage that's comfortable for you in your particular portfolio, and you communicate that to us. If not, we can help you find that percentage. We believe that America is a great country. We've been through difficult times. This is not Japan. And we always find a way to overcome the obstacles. This time should be no different. I want to thank everybody for coming to the call today. And, Ross, if we could start with the Q&A.
Thank you, Achilles. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone now, and you will be placed in the queue in the order received. If any time you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound sign. Please listen for your name to be announced and be prepared to ask your question when prompted. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone now. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone now. And Achilles, at this time, there appears to be no questions.
Okay, great. I guess we should just wrap it up then. Why don't we do this? Just wanted to say thank you, everyone, for coming on the call. I realize that it is Friday afternoon. We do find these calls timely, and a lot of people get a lot of value and benefit from them. If you do happen to have any questions and would like to speak to us offline, by all means, you have the number here, 212-461-2288, or you can contact us via email at aq@laureawealth.com. Thank you again. I hope you enjoy the day and have a wonderful day and weekend.
This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for attending and have a great day.